Welcome back to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. 40 years after people with intellectual disabilities were moved from institutions and into community life, producers of an upcoming documentary are now examining what happened to some of those people in South Dakota. Some of the men and women interviewed for the documentary so far are in their 80s, but still vividly remember the day they entered institutional care and the courage it took for them to leave and then find a new life. South Dakota writer Paul Higbee is on the creative team of Thai Media Services in Rapid City, which is producing the documentary. He's been conducting some of those interviews. He's looking for more people to talk to. The idea for the documentary, titled A Quiet Revolution, was proposed by retired educator Bob Markvie. They're both with us on the line. And Paul and Bob, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Great to be here.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having us.
Well, Bob, I'd like to start with you since you first proposed the idea. Why did you think this would be a good subject for a documentary?
You know, I was I worked with people with disabilities in South Dakota for almost 40 years and was part of the deinstitutionalization movement that happened back in the 70s here. And it was just actually such a perfect storm of things had to happen to make this possible. I mean, there needed to be things on the national level, on the state level, on the local level. There are so many facets to the story, and one of which, of course, is really important is the voices of the people who were living in institutional care and also their parents, because a big part of the story is about this wonderful grassroots movement in South Dakota that happened because the parents wanted something different for their kids. And it's, I think, a pretty powerful story in that we want to tell the story from the viewpoint of the people who were moved from the institution into the communities and how what their life was like and what happened and what their life is like now.
Well, Paul Higbee, how did you get involved in this production?
Well, I've worked with Bob a lot and on other projects over the years for about 30 years, and I also had a career in services to people with disabilities, and so knew Bob from that. And we did another project that Bob was involved in about two men, Art and Steve, who went on the road and helped people with disabilities understand their civil rights. And in fact, we were on this show about 4 years ago talking about that. We did make a film about these two men, and it was very well received internationally. And we thought, well, you know, there's a lot more voices out there that we should capture. As Bob said, you know, this movement really happened in the 70s. So a lot of the people we're interviewing with are getting up there in years, and we know if we don't capture this history now, we'll never get it. And so we just started moving about a year ago. We did our first interviews, and then we've been out on the road this past month in eastern South Dakota getting more interviews. And as Bob said, we want to tell it through the perspective of the people who are right at the heart of it and, you know, the people who were institutionalized. And it'd be easy to make a film where, you know, we've got a lot of experts who are kind of talking heads telling this story. We don't want to do that. We want it to come right from the experience of the people who are at the center of it.
Do you think, Paul, that perspective has been missing in the past?
Yeah, I really do. I think we talked a lot about helping people with disabilities get out into the communities and have jobs and residences and engage in activities in the community. But I think we have forgotten that they also have a history that we need to record, because it was a big movement, a huge movement nationally, to move out of institutions and into communities.
Well, Bob Markvie, for some background, when did that deinstitutionalization movement begin? Were there certain things that happened that caused people to rethink the way we were treating people with intellectual disabilities?
Yeah, there was legislation passed in the early 70s that assisted in helping this happen. There were some changes in Social Security. 1975, Public Law 94-142 was passed, which talked about giving a free and appropriate education for special needs kids in schools. But really going back to the impetus of change in this were the parents. The parents really wanted something different for their kids. They were presented with one option a lot of times, and that was institutional care by their doctors, by the clergy, by advisors, counselors, whatever. For years, the model was the institutional model. You know, good, bad, indifferent, that's what it was. And that's the options that a lot of people were presented with. And they really wanted something different. And they went to bat for it and proposed this legislation and lobbied. I mean, if there were an issue that came up before the South Dakota State Legislature, the ARC, or it was called the Association of Retarded Citizens at the time, they had phone trees. And, I mean, their phone trees would light up all over the state. It was very, very strong lobbying force. So that's kind of when I walked into what I was doing back in the 70s, that's the kind of thing that was going on.
Well, going back before the 70s, Bob, it must have been tough for parents, to the ones that put up their, I guess they're, what, as young as two or three, to just put them in these institutions and then not really have much to do with them anymore. That must have been heartbreaking on for both the kids and the parents.
Well, you know, it's back to I guess the strength of the people and the strength of the families. They were there weren't a lot of options out there for people. There weren't a lot of choices for people. You know, the institution afforded a choice, and like I said, it was the model, accepted model for many years. The whole idea is that there needed to be something different. There needed to be other choices for the families. Parents wanted to have their kids closer to home, and we used to hear that over and over and over again. Why are we doing this? Well, we're doing this because we want to have our son close to home. We don't want to have to travel from Leeds, South Dakota, to Redfield, South Dakota, to visit our kid. And there were people that basically that the institution was their home. It was their family. It became their home and family. And then conversely, it was kind of tough for those people then to leave that and then to move out into a community that was very strange to them.
You mentioned Redfield. Was that the only institution in the state, or were there others?
No, there was also an institution in Custer. At the time, it was a very a lot smaller population.
Now, a lot of the stories we hear about what was happening, some heartbreaking stories of abuse and neglect in some of these institutions elsewhere. Was any of that happening in South Dakota?
South Dakota did not, its movement did not result from any class action lawsuit or scandal of abuse, as happened in other states, probably most famously Willowbrook Institution in New York State. So what Bob said about this being a grassroots movement, that's exactly what it was. It wasn't the state responding to a crisis. It was South Dakotans themselves saying, we really need something better for our children. And it also really coincided with the civil rights movement nationally, people saying, people have rights regardless of race, creed, religion, and it was easy to say, and also regardless of disability.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We're talking with South Dakota writer Paul Higbee, along with retired educator Bob Markvie. They're two of the people working on a new documentary called A Quiet Revolution. It deals with the people of intellectual disabilities who are moved out of institutions and then into community life. They're interviewing some of the people who lived in the institutions, still looking for some more people to talk to. You're concentrating on South Dakota in A Quiet Revolution. Bob, are there certain things that are unique about the South Dakota perspective in this story?
I think that one of the things, excuse me, one of the things that comes to mind is that what South Dakota has done with this process is something that I think they can be very proud of. I think the system that has been set up, the options that are available to people with disabilities in South Dakota, it's very well done. I've done consulting all over the country and in similar types of programs. And I keep coming back and looking at what's going on in South Dakota, and what's going on here in the state is very, very good. I really am pretty proud of what we've done over the years and the process and the supports that we've been able to provide for people.
Well, Paul Higbee, from your perspective, do you think there's anything unique about the South Dakota side of this story?
Well, Bob and I were talking about this the other day, and South Dakota was a microcosm of what was going on nationally, and really a microcosm. You know, small numbers compared to massive numbers in states with bigger populations. So that gives us an advantage in tracking down people, locating them, and also interviewing a very high percentage of the people who are still alive from that. It's amazing in talking to people doing interviews. They'll say, hey, you ought to talk to my friend who I was institutionalized with, over in Mitchell or over in Sioux Falls or over in Rapid City. They're still the people who are kind of the alumni of our institutions are still in a way a small community, and that's helped us a lot in finding the right people to interview. And we want to get everybody that we can. If we were saying that in California, it'd be impossible to come up with a very high percentage. But here we can come up with a very, very high percentage of people who live that experience.
You've been interviewing a number of people, as you mentioned, Paul. What are they happy to, or willing to talk?
It's been the sort of thing where they're so happy to talk about it. In some cases they're putting on their best suit of clothes, and we'll sit there and talk to us all day if we have that time, and we are making a lot of time to talk. So yeah, we could not ask for a more receptive a group of people to interview, and a lot of the people we're interviewing are very aware that they were a part of a big moment in American history.
And how old are they today? What, 70s, 80s?
Yeah, the youngest person we've interviewed is 63, and then on up to 80.
Can you give us an idea, Paul, of some of the stories that they're telling you? Are they stories of sadness, difficulties, or plenty of fun memories as well?
It is really the whole range of stories you can imagine. Some, talking about the fear of going to the institution when they were very young as children. Some of them talking about it being a place where they felt like they didn't have the right to make any decisions about coming and going. Even what they did during the course of the day. But then it goes to other stories of friendships they made, fun activities, and then especially everybody can tell you the date that they left and, what an exciting day that was. That's not to say it wasn't also a little bit frightening or even very frightening, but I'm amazed that absolutely everybody can tell you the exact date that they left the institution to enter community life. And we interviewed a man in Sioux Falls, and he said, I want to quote Martin Luther King, free at last, free at last. So it's the whole range of human emotions. We even have heard some funny stories about attempting to escape Redfield. One man we talked to got off the Redfield grounds and hopped a freight train, I think got as far as Madison.
What does it tell us, Bob, that these people remember the day that they were released, that they were finally free, that was the day that they really remember?
That I think it says a couple of things. One is that you can imagine the routine of life, of living in an institution where things every day is pretty much the same. And then all of a sudden you have this day where everything changes. your routine changes, your clothes change, your surroundings change, you go on a trip. For a lot of people, when you talk about them, they hadn't really had any experience traveling or going someplace, so getting in a car with someone and traveling to Rapid City across the state of South Dakota was a huge deal. As Paul said, there had to be some major anxiety, and I know there are some people have voiced this also, that there was a lot of anxiety about where am I going, what's going to happen to me now. I was in one place, I was comfortable with that, I was told I was going to be living here for the rest of my life, and then all of a sudden this has changed. And I don't think the idea of that day, of the idea of I am totally free at that point, was really foremost in their minds. I think what was in their minds at that point in time, from what I'm hearing anyhow, is that this was just a huge change. This is a huge date for change for them. It was exciting. It was frightening. It was like Christmas. It was like all kinds of things. So I think it's a pretty wonderful date, and you see people light up when they give you that date.
I think it really tells you there is this universal human need to feel a sense of freedom, to be free. And I agree with Bob. The day that some of the people who were interviewing left the institution, that wasn't the thing they were thinking about. There was a lot of anxiety and excitement. But it was later, upon reflecting what happened, they associated it with gaining freedom.
The title of the documentary you're working on is A Quiet Revolution. What does that mean within the context of the film? I don't know who wants to take that, Paul or Bob.
Well, I think, you know, we talk about, I mentioned how this was very much connected to the civil rights movement, and a lot of the civil rights movement was very noisy, and that was true in South Dakota as we looked at what was happening in Wounded Knee in 1973, and it got a lot of attention. This was a revolution that was going on simultaneously. It was also about civil rights, but it was, for most people, kind of out of sight, and it happened. And now you talk to people in communities, and in their minds, it's like people within electoral communities have always lived there, and they almost missed that revolutionary movement where the people with intellectual disabilities were moving in big numbers.
How much work has been done so far on the documentary, Paul, and what needs to be done yet?
Well, we've done about 16 intensive interviews, interviewing people who came out of the institution, also some really powerful interviews with family members. We had a great interview with a woman in Sioux Falls who said it was really hard to be the sister of somebody who was placed in an institution, because she said, I kind of felt like my parents were doing that for us, for the children at home who were not did not have a disability, so we'd have a normal life. And she said that weighs pretty hard on you. So pretty good range of interviews, but we're just getting started. We want to do as many people as we can find. We're also in the process of raising some funding through a Kickstarter campaign, and we'll just see where our funding takes us. But if we had to stop right now and go with what we have, we could come up with a small documentary, but we want to make this full length.
And for people that may be interested in, or they know someone that might be good for being interviewed for this project, you have a website. Does that work?
Yeah, we do. It's www.quietrevolutionmovie.com.
QuietRevolutionMovie.com, and they can find more information about that and how to get involved.
Yeah, there's a Facebook page, and but yeah, probably go to the website first.